my first guest, and I think we'll just go right there. Robert Brandon is the co-founder and president of the Fair Elections Center. And, he has had a great seat to talk about what we've accomplished and what still needs to be done. Bob, welcome back. Can you hear me?
Thank you, Edwin.
Bob, you worked very hard to help make sure that there were people in every polling place across America. Just not an easy task when that job has become a little more frightening and people are intimidated. I'm in awe of my fellow citizens that we just proved again that we know how to run large, free, and fair elections. I mean, I'm particularly grateful to those in this cycle, Republicans and Democrats, who lost and then conceded. I think they did the country a huge favor in restoring confidence in elections and after all the damage of Mr. Trump. I'm also in awe of the people that you recruited, the tens of thousands, I don't know the number, millions, I don't know, of almost volunteers, of people who worked in polling places throughout the cycle. I think it's just when you see your neighbors doing that, it's harder to, cause the kind of chaos that people were worried about. And I'd love to get your take on that.
Sure, and you're talking about, of course, the effort that the Fair Elections Center has been doing for a number of years now to recruit poll workers. And in 2020, when the pandemic was going to lead to a massive number of people, because the poll workers tended to be older and concerned about their health as they should have been, we were able to launch Power the Polls, which recruited in the end over 700,000 people to apply to be poll workers. And we, largely were able to keep the polling sites open during the 2020 election, which was the largest turnout in history. In 2022, that same effort, which was, less needed slightly because turnout in midterms is usually lower, and also, partially because of the work that was done in 2020, there was, somewhat of a new generation of poll workers who were starting to do the work and were going to sign up again. But we wound up signing up over 260,000 people for this election, and the program stayed in touch with election officials to make sure that where there were shortages, we could crank up and look for more volunteers to be poll workers, both during early voting and on election day. So, and again, in the end, there were very few places that were affected by the lack of poll workers. And I would just say, which I think you were alluding to, as we watched this year and the threats from some of the crazy fringes of our country, we're going to go get people to stack the polls. We're going to go get people to clean out all the fraud. In the end, people signed up to do their job, to run the election, and election officials did the same under, in some cases, very difficult circumstances. We certainly had and saw a number of election officials decide to retire. This is a hard job. People don't completely appreciate how difficult it really is in this day of technology, and constant eye watch, with people watching over what their job is. But in the end, the election officials again have done their job. The volunteers and the poll workers have done their job, and American voters went to the polls and participated in another very well-run, fair, and transparent election.
I'm almost speechless in awe of my fellow citizens. I was once, an election monitor in another country, and they, I think, wanted to run a fair election, but they didn't really know how yet. They didn't have their public wasn't participating in it in a way that allowed them to staff all the polling places. They didn't have a sort of sense among the population of what the rules were or how it worked, and it wasn't really a great election. We Americans are good at this, and we don't really understand how complicated it is to have millions of people cast a vote and have those votes counted.
Yeah, as I said, and as you just alluded to, it's a somewhat complicated process. And one of the reasons is that there are many checks to make sure that not only are people able to cast their ballot, but it's counted properly. So there's, in every instance, there's recounts. There are what are called audits, which is essentially taking various chosen groups of ballots and matching them against, for example, the machine count and literally the paper count, so they could match a paper ballot with how it was counted in the machines. And invariably, it is always accurate because the technology has gotten so good. Occasionally you saw this year some rogue and somewhat misguided county officials who said, you know what, these machines, it's all fraud. They're being controlled by China or outer space or someplace. And they refused to have machines do the balloting. So, number one, it's illegal in a lot of places because you need some access to electronic machines that are available to people with disabilities who can't cast a regular paper ballot. But also, hand counting, they wanted to hand count all the ballots, and that would mean weeks of hand counting, and hand counting notoriously is inaccurate, which is why we've moved to machines and optical scan machinery and so on, with a backup of paper ballots and a paper trail, so everything can be double checked. So that's why, for example, you've seen, well, why was Maricopa County taking so long? Because the state law required them to not start counting ballots until after Election Day for all those, millions of ballots that came in, or in the case of the county, hundreds of thousands that came in beforehand during the early voting period or the mail ballot period. And then they double-check them. And, they're double-checked in a room with an observer from both parties. And, and that takes a lot of time, as you saw it play out. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic to me that the people that complained the most about the length of time it was taking, they were undermining the very process to make sure that there was accurate counting that they claim is the problem.
Yeah, well, I think they did that on purpose. They're undermining our confidence is part of the goal. But before we get to that sort of political point, just in the nuts and bolts, when you run an enormous election like we have, things don't always go smoothly, right? And it's important to have the infrastructure, the legal infrastructure, not just the technical infrastructure, to be able to react quickly when, for example, a polling place in some county doesn't open on time, the ability to have emergency litigation so that judges can extend hours. I think that happened in a couple of Texas counties, but it frequently happens. Sort of the handling of bumps is part of the normal process of fair elections.
Right, and you pointed to one of the more typical situations, although it's not, it's still rare, but it happens in every election, where machines aren't working because the electricity. I remember literally in Ohio, there was they had trouble connecting, they had trouble getting the machines to work, and they were connected internally with a Wi-Fi system. And they couldn't get, they don't go to the internet, just to be clear, they're just internally connected, and couldn't get them going. Somebody did go to court. The judges kept the polls open for an extra 3 hours to account for the fact that it took them 3 hours. The way they got it open is one of the young poll workers went and reset the modem, which nobody thought about doing.
Right.
It's one reason why we really encourage young people to be poll workers. They tend to be more technologically savvy. They, in many cases, you can find more bilingual speakers in the younger age group. That's part of the reason that we've launched these major efforts to diversify and bring in a new generation of poll workers.
I once had to go out and get an extension cord. Just because they didn't, somehow one was missing. And so we had to go out and get one to make sure that all of the, places, the individual spots where people could vote were up and running. It's amazing that things work as smoothly as they do, but that there's grown up a cadre of lawyers around the country, and the courts know it's coming and are prepared for it, all to deal with the bumps in the road so that we can have a fair and transparent process that accounts for the kinds of things that would normally go wrong when you say to, 200 million people, hey, you can show up and vote. I mean, I'm in awe that it works as well as it does, and that we handle the bumps as calmly as we normally do. And you've been part of that for a long time, because voting is now not what it was, when I was young or when you were young. I mean, now the period of voting is extended in many places, and we can vote by mail or we can vote early. That's, relatively new and becoming more of a thing. Election Day isn't Election Day anymore. It's the end of the election cycle. And that adds complexity, even as it adds convenience for the voters, like every other business that thinks about their clients.
Right. And so we're focused pretty much on the mechanics of running the election. We still have to keep in mind that there's a continuing trend in some places, in many places, to reduce that access, to reduce the convenience factor of early voting. And it happened, almost like clockwork when there was the record turnout in 2020 happened, and some state legislators saw that the numbers of young people voting have increased dramatically, the numbers of Asian Pacific Islander voters, the numbers of black women. It's not a surprise that some of these legislatures who really thrive on the fact that there's a smaller voting pool, these legislators want to choose the voters that vote for them rather than the other way around, that the voters choose mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And so we saw it, literally right after the 2020 election and the 2021 legislative sessions in Texas and Georgia and Florida and North Carolina. Currently in Ohio, they're debating a new bill that's going to restrict dramatically what was an otherwise fairly decent set of rules in Ohio, even though it's not the most expansive by any means. It's not like Illinois is now, or even Wisconsin has its own problems, but it has a lot of options. So we saw, reductions of the time to for early voting. We saw restrictions on getting mail ballots passed. So we continue to see efforts to make it harder through voter suppression. And it's a two-edged sword, because in many cases now we have voters who are going to push back against that and say, okay, you want to take my vote away? I'm not going to let you. I'm going to make that extra step in order to vote. But we also know that there are people that wind up not voting because of some of these changes.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you about that. I know voter suppression is still a thing, or is a thing again. And just so that everybody listening knows, Democrats have a historical ability to be just as guilty as Republicans in this. Here in Chicago, where I live, the election for mayor is in February. And those of you who don't live in Chicago, February in Chicago is not a time that anybody wants to be outside. They did that so that, the city workers would vote because their jobs depended on it, and the rest of the people might stay home. So this isn't really partisan, although right now around the country, it's a Republican issue, not a Democratic one. But historically, everybody's been guilty. Bob, in Georgia, you go and you look at the news, and there were long lines of people to vote where everybody was a person of color. There were not long lines when people were voting who weren't. That should just be illegal, but I guess our Supreme Court has washed their hands of these issues. And I know that at least in the numbers I've seen, the black vote is down a little bit this cycle compared to the last. I don't know if that's just because it's off year, but those trends worry me.
Yeah, it is somewhat off year. The issue about adequate resources 64 polling places has been around for a while. And it, you know, it is absolutely true that historically and traditionally and even now, there are many areas where the, you know, if in case of Georgia, the legislature, the governor, the people running the elections are largely Republicans, even though some county officials are Democratic. But still, in those counties that are traditionally urban counties with high levels of voters who would tend to be Democratic, the resources are not there, and the long lines are a tribute to both enthusiasm over voting and a lack of resources. And I can just add to that, as you know, the Fair Election Center has run for now almost 12 years at the Campus Vote Project, where we partner with college campuses around the country to get the schools to be drivers of information and action so that their students can vote. And we saw many areas where, you know, we've heard about the youth turnout was enormous this time, second highest in the last 30 years for a midterm, and long lines at college campuses. And, you know, on one hand, we celebrate that. On the other hand, we say, we have to do something about election officials not providing the same support for young people trying to become more involved in our democracy than they do for other voters.
Bob, I need to take a break. It's the bottom of the hour, but I do want to talk a little bit more about young voters when we come back. Everybody, stay tuned. More with Bob Brandon in just a moment.
You're listening to The Big Picture with Edwin Eisentraff on WCPT 820.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Bob Brandon. He is, of course, the president and co-founder of the Fair Elections Center, a national nonpartisan voting rights and election reform organization based in our nation's capital. Bob, we were talking about this before the break. Young people showed up for a lot of reasons, but among them to tell all of us older statesmen that the democracy is safe in their hands. They really came out in droves. Remind everybody again about your Campus Vote Project and the impact that you have seen this cycle.
Sure. And as I mentioned, the Campus Vote Project, which we launched in 2012 in partnership with many of the college administrators around the country, with the basic premise that our institutions of higher education are the places where young people should learn about the most fundamental part of our democracy, which is voting. So, you know, we partner and provide resources, as we do for all voters, like in all 50 states, information on how you can vote and register and so on, to the campuses, to the administration, to the faculty, so that they can provide that to their students. And then provide, you know, really an effort to institutionalize that knowledge year in and year out. So we're not just relying on student activists who graduate, after all. So we have a constant program, and over the years we've seen the youth vote increase pretty substantially over time, and the college vote in 2020, for example, on the colleges, over 1,000 colleges that, where there was a measurement of voting in college precincts, reached about 66%, which was just a tick under the 68% overall turnout. Now, that's extraordinary because young people typically have been voting at half the rate of the rest of us. And that has changed in the last few years in particular. In 2020, the overall rate, not just colleges, college students, but all young people, reached about 51%, which was a big jump from the 39% the election before and the highest ever. In this year, the turnout for 18 to 29-year-olds was 27%, which, as I mentioned before, was the second highest midterm turnout in the last 35 years or so. In 2018, it was 31%. It was the highest at that time.
Yeah, I think young Americans are deeply engaged and very concerned about their future. Very concerned. I know when I talk to young people, sort of the issues of the environment and whether or not they're going to have a democracy that works for them as they work through both that and other complicated issues. And I think young people are very thoughtful about those questions.
Yeah, we've done a number of research projects, focus groups, and polling, particularly this year, talking to current college students about their motivation to vote and not vote. And, you know, in addition to pointing out that they appreciate and want information from their school, you know, the very thing we're trying to build into our program, they identified the motivations they have to try to make the world a better place. You mentioned climate change is absolutely, you know, top. After the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, they many of them talked about the importance of women's health access and privacy concerns, and they mentioned gun violence quite a bit. And criminal justice generally, but gun violence in particular. And, you know, then like everybody else, they're concerned about the cost of living and inflation and whether or not they're going to have a decent job going forward.
Yeah, but they have, I mean, when you feel that way, I guess there are multiple paths you could take. One is to turn your backs on the democracy and say, it's not working for me, I got to do something else. But that's not what happened. They proved sort of once again, a kind of American patriotism that they believe that this system can work for us. And they showed up and did what Americans do. They voted. And that, I think, was an enormously hopeful sign.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would have said to you, we were talking 10 years ago, that young people care a lot about all these issues. They're not convinced that the political system can deliver for anything for them, because they looked around and saw that it really wasn't talking to them, and it was pretty dysfunctional, and it's still, you know, in many places pretty dysfunctional, but you know, certainly at some level, at the state level and at the local level, they're beginning to see some of the things they care about being addressed. I know they pointed out some of the explicit things about the administration, the Biden administration's delivering on some things, like the student loan debt relief was a big deal for people. You know, doing something about, you know, to the extent that some of them have been following the gun violence issues, doing something about gun violence.
Right.
You know, again, a little esoteric, but hearing about the Justice Department banning chokeholds and investigating police departments that have been, you know, considered fairly rogue to police departments in terms of how they police, particularly neighborhoods of color. So, you know, they're smart, they're aware, they're concerned, and for many of them, you could see it in the protests, and you could also just see it in the day-to-day decision to help their community, you know, volunteer and so on. And so for me, those things are all extremely important, but if they don't decide that the democracy we have is going to help deliver some of those things, then we're all in trouble. So it's a hopeful sign to see them getting more involved.
I agree. And young people ran for office at many levels this cycle, and some did pretty well. All of that, I think, is really important, really important.
You know, we mentioned in some of these focus groups, because just like everybody else, people go, yeah, I voted, but I'm not sure my one vote matters. Or, you know, I actually didn't vote. I got really busy. I forgot. And besides, my one vote doesn't matter. But we were able to say to the people that we talked to in this research, do you know that your generation had the highest turnout they ever have had, and it in 2020, and it resulted in the election of the youngest, most diverse Congress in history. When they hear that, they go, oh, it wasn't my single vote. It was all of us making our voices heard actually had an impact. And now they can look at people, you know, like the 25-year-old that just got elected from South Florida, Maxwell Alejandro Frost, who was an organizing director for March for Our Lives, the effort by young people that spontaneously came up after the Parkland shootings. And he, who is a young man who's Afro-Cuban descent, And he got elected. And, you know, many other people in their 30s were elected in this Congress. And so, you know, that's another thing that young people, young voters can point to and say, well, we're going to start seeing people that are like us.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. And I think the work that you have done and, you know, the Fair Elections Center has done over time has helped make that transition possible, has helped invite young people sort of to participate and to show them that they have real power. It's a gift.
I like to think that's true, and I do think that's true. That's why we do the work we do. But mm-hmm. I'd also say it's a tribute to the people that work with us. We have a large, young, diverse staff, but more importantly, every year we pay about 300 students across the country to work with their administration and their faculty and their colleagues on campus to help everybody understand what the rules are, how you get involved running for office, or how you get involved mm-hmm. in voting, making sure you're registered, know what the rules are. And those people, we invest a lot to make sure they understand the strength and power they have as young people organizing for the future.
It's a great gift from one generation to the next, and so important for the continuity of democracy. It's just impossible to overstate. Let's change, though, from a happy topic like that to an unhappy topic. I refer to Ohio as the land that democracy forgot. I mean, what do you make of sending 15 members to Congress who were selected from districts that the Ohio Supreme Court said were not constitutional and couldn't be used? The message it sends to me is there is no power in the land to redress that outrage.
Yeah, it's pretty disappointing. And you know, this was another example of where legislators turned their back on the will of the people. So there was an effort initially by grassroots organizations and good government organizations and organizations working to mobilize and getting involved the various constituencies that have traditionally been underrepresented to pass a citizens commission on redistricting. The legislature weighed in, and in order to sort of avoid that being put on the ballot, they came up with a hybrid program that they knew they could largely ignore, which is essentially what they did. And then with a lot of the crazy machinations back and forth, in the end, it wound up in the courts. And the courts, in this case, the state Supreme Court in Ohio, which is a, you know, these are partisan elections. I mean, they're called nonpartisan, but the right. The judges are Republican or Democrat, and the majority was Republican. And so they, you know, basically left in place what was a gerrymandered district. Now, Ohio is not the worst gerrymandered state by any means, but it was on its way. It was supposed to be on its way to have a better system. And what the legislation that set up this commission, hybrid commission / legislature process, basically said, well, if it doesn't work and we don't agree together that it's a good system going after 2020 for the 2022 election, we can come back and revisit it, not in 10 years, but in 4 years. That was their sort of fail-safe. And so the voters of Ohio, unfortunately, are going to have to wait another election cycle before they can potentially address the what clearly was considered a unconstitutional gerrymandering.
Yep. And now in Ohio, choosing your own voters by gerrymandering, they succeeded in doing government of the party, by the party, and for the party. But apparently that's not enough. Now they are actively trying to restrict voting in other ways to roll back some of that openness that you talked about earlier. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it's going to make it harder for military people to vote. It's going to make it harder for everybody.
The legislature, which is about to end, you know, in a week, is rushing through two bills to one is clawing back a lot of the changes that have been made over the years, shortening early voting periods. Making it more difficult to do mail balloting. There's a variety of things like that. And then literally at the last minute, they substituted for a 15-page bill, 147-page bill. And it's got even more of that stuff in it. And then separately, they've introduced another bill that would provide, in Ohio for the first time, a strict photo ID law, as strict as any in the country. And they have not had that before. And so it's a little unclear, you know, it's being rushed through. The public has, 24-hour notice that they can come and talk about it if they want in the legislature session. It's kind of a joke. And, we'll see. I mean, we're involved in legislative advocacy in about 15 states around the country where we work with both our campus program people and other allies that are doing a lot of voter rights work on the ground. So everybody's trying to weigh in Ohio, but it's a state that's got a conservative Republican legislature in the House and the Senate, a governor who's a Republican. I think we'll see. I think a lot of people are unaware of this because it happens so quickly with so little public notice. Whether or not there can be enough outcry or not, I don't know. And whether, I have my one suspicion is that the ID law, which looks really bad, maybe is the way to deflect attention from all the other stuff, which is quite bad as well. But maybe they don't pursue the one and they get all the other. Now, that's me just speculating. I have no idea if that's true or not. But
yeah, I mean, it's I don't think the public outcry will matter to them. You know, they're so gerrymandered. And again, they're not Wisconsin, but they're pretty close, that the legislators don't care what the voters think because they pick them. They can't be held accountable for anything.
Right. I mean, this is obviously the problem with gerrymandering all over the country, as you mentioned. Yep. But, whether you've got Wisconsin or, Pennsylvania or North Carolina or Florida or Georgia, you name it, Texas. The Democrats were perfectly fine doing this.
And Illinois.
That's right.
In Illinois, yep.
But we do now have a system where you don't have to worry because everybody's in a safe district. And so there's no reason to be responsive to a broader constituency to try to get things done.
And I believe our United States Supreme Court said, the federal courts are closed to this discussion. Don't bother coming to us with gerrymandering.
Yeah, we'll see. The one place that it's been stopped is when it's been considered a violation of the Voting Rights Act because of racial gerrymandering. The Supreme Court, as you're alluding to, in the last term said, well, purely partisan gerrymandering, they were just trying to gain advantage for one party over the other. We don't really have a role in that. And, it is interesting that the North Carolina State Supreme Court weighed in under the state's constitution. But I can tell you that the state Supreme Court has just flipped from a majority Democratic to a majority Republican. So we'll see what happens there. But
yes, Ohio's court got more Republican this time.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Yep. So they will after the fact, approve the maps that were unconstitutional before. But I'm not a lawyer. I always thought the law wasn't dependent on the personnel. But hey.
What I was taught in law school is that facts in the law matter and jurisprudence relies on precedent and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it really tests you as a lawyer to see what's going on. And it's a reflection of how divided the country has become and how few people there are that are willing to just follow the rules and the law. And if they don't like it, they're going to change it to take advantage and try to gain more power. And that just, that's the part that all of us that are trying to make sure our democracy is vibrant really worry about.
I do think, by and large, the courts, whether the judge was nominated by Democrat or Republican, the federal courts, by and large, have done their job and done it credibly. I do not count the Supreme Court in that. I've lost my faith in them. But the courts generally, even where they've made mistakes, they've tried to correct them. So I think we still have a functioning independent judiciary, notwithstanding what's going on at the top.
And, you know, it's a big part of our organization, too. We litigate all over the country. We challenge some of these laws. We've been successful in a number of places. We haven't been successful in some. But, you know, you have to do everything you can. And I agree with you that, you know, not just the federal courts and the state courts still have a residual of making decisions that are not purely ideological and political. Yeah. I do share your concern about the Supreme Court because we know there are individual justices on there now that seem to not be particularly focused on the traditions and the importance of following precedent and in this current Supreme Court, but rather running an ideological agenda.
Yeah. Outcome-based law. I see that when I worked in Saudi Arabia. You know, rule by law is not rule of law. Mm. Not even close. Not even close. So Bob, the last sort of topic for us, and we have a few minutes left, I just want to look forward to the next presidential cycle. And, you know, you have stuff bubbling up in states all over the place. But we've now had a couple of elections where, you know, pretty major folks, from an ex-president to a lot of people running around the country, were doing everything they could to tell Americans elections don't work. Elections are crooked. Elections need to be undermined. We kind of held the line and didn't buy their nonsense and fought back and won. But what are we looking at in the next 2 years? I mean, I see some big threats still. The independent state legislature doctrine high on my list. It should never get a hearing, let alone a hearing at the Supreme Court. What are the threats that we have to pay attention to?
Yeah. Well, I share your concerns. You know, I think in this election cycle, we were able to, as you said and I said, people turned out, you know, whether it was the people running the elections or people voting, that made a difference in terms of those that were threatening to stop elections, threatening to challenge them after they were, the votes were cast and so on. We shouldn't assume that that's not going to happen again. We'd like to think that it's maybe less likely, but it all depends on how jazzed up some of these unhinged people are and whether the former president is going to continue to do what he's been doing, which is both undermining our democracy and getting lots of people to, you know, not understand how our democracy works. So that's a concern. I think there's also, because of the control, the partisan nature of election of legislatures these days in some states, there continues to be some concern that not only are we going to see more voter suppression, but efforts to try to really undermine election results by just taking the decision on certifying elections back to the legislature and do it in a partisan way. And which gets us a little bit to the independent state legislative theory, which is a whole different show probably, but you know, it just got a hearing at the Supreme Court. We're very proud of the fact that our organization filed an amicus brief on behalf of the League of Women Voters of the U.S. and all 50 of their state chapters, talking about the chaos that would ensue if you wound up having a situation where state legislatures can pass laws that violate the state constitution, but state courts cannot look at them and challenge them because there's a clause in the elections clause of the federal constitution that says the states have the control over the manner and time of federal elections. That really wasn't meant to be, and therefore we can also decide who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote.
Yes, there's nothing in our history that says, I mean, even pre-Lincoln history in America, everyone was concerned about balancing power, having checks and balances, three branches in the federal government, federalism itself. These were all to make sure that we didn't have a tyrant. And now they're considering a theory that says one group cannot, you can't question what they did on an issue of elections, period. It's up to them. And that is, again, the non-lawyer in me looks at these so-called originalists, people who care about what the founder said, but apparently have never hired a historian in the history of the Supreme Court, because they don't care that much about what they really thought, are going to give us some unaccountable anything to do with elections. Seems bizarre and dangerous. I agree with you. I'm terrified of this. I do note, Bob, the hearing that they held was on, I mean, how apt is this? Was on December 7th. They're going to hear this case about destroying our democracy on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Right. I did remind my staff, you know, that when they were getting ready to put our brief in, that when they announced the hearing date, I said, you know, that's a day that will live in infamy, right?
Yeah.
And some of them, you know, some of our staff are a little bit younger. It doesn't resonate quite as much, but that's a good point. The other thing about that theory is that if it went through, and I don't believe it will, I think it's so extreme and it's been settled for so long that isn't the way we run the elections. You'd have two sets of elections in all these states. You'd have state law, governed elections that could be managed by the courts if they were unconstitutional at state level, mm-hmm. and federal elections that would be separate. And so you'd have people would have to go and get two different ballots. They'd have to
have different voter registration,
different standards. Exactly.
Yeah.
It would be chaos everywhere.
Yep. But those who don't like the idea of democracy seem to like the idea of throwing our elections into chaos. I mean, once again, in Arizona, I guess the loser of the governor's race there has decided to file court. I don't know if there's any jurisdiction in the country that is more skilled at defending its good work in court than Maricopa County.
Yeah. No,
going to have to do it again.
I think everybody has gotten to the point where they really know how to run elections correctly. Now, that's not to say that there aren't many laws that have gotten in the way of people mm-hmm. being able to easily and successfully cast a ballot. And as we know, it's particularly targeted the constituencies that have traditionally been underrepresented because of barriers that were put in the way. Yeah. And that includes young people and the constituencies of color and immigrant communities and so on. And the disabled community, we're representing a number of people with disabilities. We're going to be filing something in Arizona that because there's a law there that says people with disabilities can't have anybody help them cast their ballot or deliver it except an immediate family member. We're talking to paralyzed veterans of America who are in institutions whose social workers have often helped them with ballot access, and now they can't do that if this law goes through, and we're going to have to challenge.
Well, I, as always, I'm grateful for our conversations and more grateful for the work that you and the center do year in and year out to keep our elections free and fair and accessible to every citizen who wants to vote.
Well, thanks, Edwin. I always appreciate chatting with you. And if people want to get more information about us, we can go to fairelectioncenter.org and find out more about the work we do and can support us.
Always good at the end of year. Every organization needs those end of year dollars. So those of you who are interested in this good work, get online, Fair Election Center, find it, contribute. Bob, thanks so much. Have a happy new year.
And you too, Edwin. Good to talk to you.
Okay.
Take care.
All right, everybody. We will be back in after the news with Kyle Tharp, and we're going to talk about digital campaigning. Some really interesting stuff as we analyze what happened in the last election. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Big Picture with Edwin Eisendrath on WCPT 820.